I told you I was going to make it short. Leave it up to me. Again, I would like to thank Nell for coming and to introduce Nell from Warika, Oklahoma. Here's Nell.
I'll tell you, I don't know what I'm supposed to do after two introductions. And I hated to miss the warm-up act. My name is Nell, and I'm a very, very grateful member of Al-Anon. Hello, everyone. I am from Warika, Oklahoma, a member of the Gypsy Group. And I think I'll just tell you why we call ourselves the Gypsies. When I came into Al-Anon, we didn't have a group in Warika, and we made meetings in Wichita Falls, Texas, and Duncan and Gainesville, Texas, and all the surrounding towns that had an AA, an Al-Anon group. And when we'd walk in, they'd say, well, here come those Warika Gypsies. So we named ourselves the Gypsy Group. It's wonderful to be here. And I can't thank you enough for the warmth and love that you've already shown me. Britt did this with the first phone call when she invited me. And then that was followed by other phone calls and some correspondence. And then Steve and Linda picked me up at the airport in Pittsburgh yesterday. How many of you have ever ridden with Steve? I'm extremely grateful to be here, more than you know. We stopped at McDonald's on the way and celebrated his birthday, and that was fun. And then I got to Britt's house, and that's where I spent the night last night. And Britt and her husband, Hiller, and her darling little three-year-old girl made me feel very, very welcome. And then Tian and Britt brought me on here today. And it was a wonderful trip. Tian's a pretty good driver. She just doesn't know where she's going half the time. So it's been an interesting trip up to now. And no telling, what I would have had to have told you had I waited till Sunday at the rate things are going now. But a very special gift this weekend is to see Margaret again, and Blanche. Blanche and I have known each other for a long, long time, but we don't get to be together very, very much. And so this is a real treat for me. She's a very special person in my life, and I don't tell her enough how much I love her. This morning, Emma and I, Britt's three-year-old, were playing dolls. And Emma would say to me, I am going to say such and such. And she had the girl doll, and I had the boy doll. And so I would respond, and she would say, no, that isn't what I want you to say. Would you believe I identified with that child? So, that happened many, many times in my house. And I'm really sorry that Cleve can't be here tonight. Someone just brought a picture that was taken of us, I don't know how many years ago. I was about 20 pounds lighter, I think, in Winston-Salem. At a convention there, and I looked at that picture and I thought, I really miss that old boy. And not only that, I kind of hate for him to miss an opportunity to hear how much I suffered, He ought to be here. But when I was growing up, I look back on my childhood, and I have nothing but happy memories of that childhood. I have very loving and beautiful mother, and I had a very loving and very handsome father. And I was an only child for almost 7 years. Now, during this period of time, I look back and I can see where my mother was the wise one in the family in her discipline and her care for me, and my father was the one I could manipulate. And the only thing that ever gave me any trouble were the no's in my life, and I could quickly change my father's no's to yeses. And life for me was good. Now, mother was a little different because she's the first one I think I ever had to get even with. She punished me one time by making me stand in the closet. And I cried and blew my nose on her dresses. And you know, I can remember how good that made me feel. It was kind of like the first time I hit Cleve. It was just wonderful. Now, I think hitting him was sort of like the alcoholic taking that first drink. It changed the way I felt that evening. And you know, I'm not proud of those things. And I'll talk about other things tonight that I'm not really proud of. But you have a theme that I like very, very much. It's called A Stairway to Freedom. And you know, each step up gives us a vision. And what you gave me was a vision beyond my circumstances. That was my gift, my wonderful gift from you. But as I said, in growing up, life was good. I did a lot of play liking. We called it plike. My little friends would come over, and as I said, I identified with them. I would say, plike I say this, and plike you say that. And if they didn't plike right, they went home, you know. But I didn't have any place to send Cleve when he quit pliking right. My teenage years were during the war, the big one, the one that made the papers, remember? WW2. And I went to a lot of movies, and I saw a lot of romantic things. And I saw the Flyboys. And I thought they were wonderful. And my sophomore year in high school, when I was about 16, it was my junior year, I don't remember. I visited a friend on the campus of the University of Oklahoma, and the boys were back from the war. And she had gotten me a date with one of these young men, and I was terribly excited and feeling very grown up. And there stood this very handsome man in a tweed coat and Argyle socks, loafers. He was wearing a fraternity pin and smoking a pipe. And I knew that he was studying for a profession. And I quickly went over my little mental checklist. And those of you who know Cleve will understand, the only thing I had to mark out was tall. And I really liked him. Well, he kissed me on the cheek when he told me goodnight, and he gave me a nickel. And now this is how long ago it was. Before it's over, you'll know how old I am. Don't worry. But he gave me a nickel and he said, call me when you become of age. I kept that nickel and I didn't forget what he said. I went to a girl's school, and you just don't forget things like that when you go to a girl's school. So we did start dating my sophomore year in college and his senior year in law school during Christmas vacation. Now, you see, Cleve was raised in Warrica, where we live now, and I was raised in Ryan. And these two towns are 10 miles apart, but we didn't know one another growing up. I like to say it's because he's so much older than I am, but you know, 4 or 5 years can make a difference in your school years. But anyway, we started dating during the Christmas vacation, and oh, I thought he was wonderful. And he came over for my sweetheart dance in February, and it was at that dance that he asked me to wear his fraternity pin. And we talked about getting married in the fall. But you know, that time just seems so long, and finally I convinced him that it should be June. I always wanted to be a June bride, and I was. And life was good. He was finishing his senior year, and we lived in Norman, Oklahoma on the campus, and it was wonderful. And you know, alcohol was really a very fun part of our lives. Having grown up in the Bible Belt and living in a home where alcoholic beverages were never served, I was taught how to drink beer. And I thought that was terribly sophisticated. So, as I said, it certainly didn't pose any problems, and all I could see was that it was adding to this maturity that I was certainly gaining at that time. After he finished law school and was admitted to the bar, the legal bar, that is, we lived in Tulsa for a while. Now, this, too, was a fun town, and I had my first cocktail party there. And, you know, I had seen all of these things in the movies, and I was so excited. And sometimes Cleve drank too much, but that just made him cuter as far as I was concerned then. And after a year in Tulsa, we decided to move back to Waurika. We just kind of wanted to get back to our part of Oklahoma. We live on the prairies of Oklahoma in cattle country. And Waurika is the county seat, and it's a town of about 3,000. And there are more cattle than people in our county, I think. But it was a good life. And he hung out a shingle, and you know, I knew that he'd be building a practice and there wouldn't be much money, but somehow I was comfortable with this because I knew my daddy was just 10 miles away. And Cleve had made the mistake one time of saying that my father was such a wonderful man, he'd like to be just like him, and I thought so would I. But this was still a fun time. There were a lot of young couples in Waurika then, and we made a place for ourselves there in the civic clubs and the social activities and in the church, the community, and felt very much at home. And we had lots of bring-your-own-bottle parties because Oklahoma was dry. Then Cleve was appointed county judge, and we had access to all the confiscated hooch that was in the sheriff's vault. So we were a very popular young couple. And we can tell those things because the statutes of limitations have run against us. But life was fun. And you know, all of the things that I had planned and all the things that I had dreamed were happening, and just like I wanted them to. And I decided it was time to start my family. Well, things just didn't work out there like I had planned, and so I started the rounds of many, many doctors and was finally told after lots of tests that in all probability I would never bear a child. You know, I suppose that was the first no in my life that I couldn't do anything about. As a child, I had a God. My first God was a God of fear. And looking over the countryside of West Virginia, I couldn't help but just now think, I wonder if you all had the old-time revivals like we used to have. And the little town would turn out for the big revivals every summer. And there'd be about 6 weeks of this. The Methodists, the Baptists, and the Nazarenes, you know, would all have these big evangelists come in, and they preached that hellfire and brimstone. We met in a big tabernacle, a room so much like this, only there were no sides in it. And we fanned ourselves with a fan that had Grantham Funeral Home written on the back. And during the 43 verses of Just As I Am, I went to the altar in all three revivals every summer. And my God was a God of fear. And finally, my mother talked to me one time, and she said that she thought public confession was only necessary one time. And I think I was about 9 at that time. Then one day I heard a Sunday school teacher talk about my Heavenly Father, and I liked that. I liked that so much better because I could compare this Heavenly Father with an earthly father. And I thought, if God is half as good as my daddy, I've got it made. So here was a time in my life that I went to my Heavenly Father, and I told him how much I wanted this baby. And I thought he said no. And you know, since coming to you, I have found that God's no's to me are simply preludes to much better yeses. But I didn't know that then. Here was something in my life that I had wanted that I couldn't have. And I became angry at God. Cleve told me not to worry about it, that we would adopt a child. And I wanted one right then. And he said, well, don't be impatient. He said, you know, I have a lot of children come through my court that need and want a home just as much as we need and want a child. And I believed him. And one day this happened. Not exactly as I had planned or dreamed, because the little boy was 6. And I'd always thought of a tiny baby. But when I saw Mike, I knew he was mine. His mother had died of alcoholism, and his dad had some trouble with the bottle, and his second wife had left, and we brought him home. And he climbed up in my lap, and he said, you're my third mother and the goodest one I ever had. Punched all my buttons. I was going to be the goodest mother he ever had. So I just simply decided that we wouldn't drink anymore. I didn't want him to have anything in our home that reminded him of something that had gone on in the other home that might create insecurity. I'll never forget the look on Cleve's face when I suggested this. There was dead silence. And then he said, I'll tell you what, Nell, I won't drink in front of the boy. And I thought that was okay. But you know, I never saw him take another drink. I don't know when this disease started in him. But I'll tell you one thing. It was at this point in our life together that I recognized uncontrolled drinking. And I didn't know what was happening. And the disease of alcoholism was manifesting itself in me, the family disease. I started reacting in all the negative ways and feelings that I'd known so briefly in my life. Feelings of fear and anxiety and resentment and anger and guilt. Oh, God, the guilt. I was surely the reason. I could not bear his child. I was somehow a failure. It's bound to be the reason this man is drinking so much. And you know, these fears stayed with me all day long. And I certainly wasn't going to talk to anybody about them. Gosh, we'd just taken this little boy. I couldn't let them know what was going on here. They might take him away from me. Hadn't his mother died of alcoholism? Didn't his daddy drink too much? Wasn't that the reason we got him? Oh, I was afraid. I was afraid. And there was nowhere to turn. I remember Cleve and I would have talks. And he would tell me why he drank so much. He would say, pressure's at the office. I don't get to play golf anymore, Nell. I need that quick pick-me-up. I'll try not to drink so much. And I would believe him. One day we got a phone call about a tiny baby in Louisiana. She weighed 3.5 pounds. and they were looking for a home for her. And oh, somehow I knew that little girl was mine. And I wanted her so much. And I said, Cleve, I just hate to bring another child into this home unless you promise me that you won't drink so much. He said, Nell, that baby is just what we need. I'm going out of public office into private practice. The pressures will be gone. Honey, things are going to change. It's going to be different. And I believed him. And we got in that car and we drove several hundred miles and we picked up this tiny baby girl. We named her Rebecca. We brought her home. And here was a dream, another dream that was coming true for me. I had a little boy and I had a little girl. And I had a husband that had promised me things were going to be different. And honey, he didn't lie. They got worse. And that old merry-go-round called alcoholism went faster and faster and faster, and I couldn't get off. And I didn't know where to go. And I went to my doctor, and I went to my minister, and I can remember how they would answer my questions with questions. And they'd say, how do you stand it, and why do you stay? And I'd leave their office feeling guilty for loving a drunk, because I didn't know why I stayed. And it was only after I came to you that I really found out why I stayed. I stayed because I had become emotionally dependent upon him for all of my neurotic needs. And had that man sobered up at that point in time, I'd have probably gone stark raving mad. I would have lost my reason for being the way that I was. I can remember when people in town found out what was going on. I want to tell you something. If any of you are living with a practicing alcoholic and do not live in a little town, move. It's wonderful. When people found out what was going on at our house, found out about his drinking, they didn't find out about my behavior. Because they thought he was terrible and I was wonderful. And I could walk down Main Street with no makeup on now because you look more pitiful this way. And I would go by the shops and invariably I could hear them say, God love her. Bless her little heart. And I would go in and somebody would always come up and put their arms around me and say, how do you stand it? And I'd just drop over and say, I don't know. It was wonderful. Just wonderful. Have you ever thought what a wonderful Al-Anon Tammy Faye Baker would be? I'm just... I soon learned the trick of the mascara bit, you know. you can sit in church and learn to let one tear drop. And here's your little mascara streak down this side. Oh, they'll just pat you and hug on you. It's just great, you know. And you always sit in the choir, too, you know, where they can see you. But, you know, I didn't know what to do. I did not know what to do. I had threatened to divorce him. Now, this doesn't work with a drunk lawyer. He offered to represent me. I'm going to tell you how sick I was. I made an appointment with him. The only thing that saved me was I couldn't afford him. But you know how they are. They want us to have the best. So we had one couple in Waurika who were attending AA in Al-Anon in Wichita Falls, Texas. This is 35 miles from us. And we had gone to this man's first birthday, and oh, I thought the AA meeting was just wonderful. But you know, I certainly didn't think Cleve was one of them. They told terrible stories about being in jail and all kinds of things. And you see, those things hadn't happened to us yet. So I just didn't think he had quite gone that far. You know, if he'd just mind and follow the script, he'd be all right. But anyway, they asked me if I would like to go to an Al-Anon meeting. Now, I didn't know what they were talking about, but I said I would go. And we drove over to Wichita Falls, and I can remember the conversation that evening and how A.C. was talking about his sobriety. He had a year. And it was just a wonderful evening. I loved being with them because, you see, I didn't have to hide anything from them. And we went into the meeting. And here was a group of lovely, lovely people. And they were smiling, and I liked that. But you know what I thought? I thought, here's a group of people who haven't heard what I'm going through. And I proceeded to tell them. I can remember how tacky the leader was that evening. She kept trying to get control of her program, you know, and talk about recovery. And I didn't know what she was talking about. Recovery? And then they'd talk about the steps. And, boy, I'll tell you, first chance I had, I was right back in there because I was thinking the whole time she was talking of something else they needed to hear. So finally I read their steps. And I came to number 12, and it said, carry the message. And Lord, I knew why I was there. This is where you go to learn how to sober up the alcoholic. I was delighted they had a training program. So as soon as that meeting was over, I went into the AA room, and I gathered up the free literature. I went home and tastefully decorated our house with it. Now, I was just ecstatic over this, you know, and I told everyone, I'm going to this thing called Al-Anon. It's wonderful. You learn how to sober them up. So, couldn't wait to get back to that next meeting. Now, I want to tell you something. Cleve was not reading that literature. And I read it to him. Now, I invited him to go on the nights that we had open meetings. And I knew that we were going to be in that other room and we were going to hear the alcoholic's side of the story. Well, he wouldn't always go. But I went. And I had a most retentive mind then. And I would sit there and I would just take in everything that was said. Because I had to share it with him. If he didn't go, I had to take it back to him. And most of the night, I would stay awake, going over and over and over the points that I thought were extremely important that the speaker had made that evening. And sometime, I added a few things that I thought would be real good, you know. And we would get up, and I was picking up on things about how to do this. They said, whatever you do, do with love. So I prefaced everything with, Cleve, I love you. And I have something wonderful to share with you this morning. And that old coffee cup would just go like that, you know. I'm sure he couldn't wait. And I'm a joy in the morning anyway, you know. But this went on for quite a little while. And I thought, well, nothing's changing here. He's a tough cookie. I'm going to have to attend these classes a lot longer than I had planned. One night, I heard a lovely Al-Anon gal say, "No one feels as unloved or as unlovely as the wife of an alcoholic." And I thought, right on. But she added something. She said, "Unless it's the alcoholic himself." It broke my heart. Because you see, for the very first time in a long, long time, I identified with a feeling. I thought, oh dear God, is he as lonely as I am? And does he feel as unloved as I do? And I went back to my Al-Anon meetings and I looked at those steps. I looked at number one. I didn't believe I was powerless. I did not believe that my life was unmanageable, because I thought I managed beautifully considering the mess I lived in. And I thought, surely, surely there is something that I can do for this man. I had become God's right-hand instrument. He didn't know it, but I thought, surely, surely there's something I can do. This doesn't make sense to me. And I certainly didn't think I was insane. Anything I did that was weird was simply brought on by his behavior, not mine. Wouldn't any good mother make a bed in the back of the station wagon if she got her children up at night to drive the streets and the alleys to look for their father? I didn't leave those little things at home. They begged to stay in bed many, many times. And I'd say, you don't think I'm that kind of mother, do you? That would go off and leave you at 3 o'clock in the morning. And I'd get them up and I'd bed them down in the back of that station wagon. We'd drive for hours until I found him. I'd find the car and find him, then go home, go to bed. And I only had to get out and do that when he got someplace that didn't have a telephone. Because the early part of the evening was spent on the phone, you know, trying to locate him. All those real necessary things. I can remember Rebecca's first sentence. "Is he dead?" We'd come in and find old Cleve lying in state in the living room floor. I've got to tell you this. When Cleve drank, he wore black. He wore a black suit, black high-heeled boots, little old black string tie, black hat, colored glasses. He'd leave the house in the morning, and I'd think, well, if anything happens to him, he's dressed for it. But here he'd be lying in state there in that old black suit, you know, and Becca'd say, "Is he dead?" I'd say, "No, darling, Daddy's just resting. And we're going to play a little game, and it's called Jumping Over Daddy." And I'd go over him and I'd kick him. And then I'd say, "Oops, Mother missed. I'll have to do it again." I can remember the time that he came home in the middle of the afternoon, and he never came home in the afternoon, and I was having a table of bridge, and I asked him what he was doing there, and he gave me some smart answer, and I said, "Well, you certainly can't stay up in this part of the house. You just go to the basement." And he did. And the girls arrived, and we were sitting there at the table, and, you know, we were dealing those cards, and you know how we can smile and have that look on our face, everything just all right. Well, about that time, old Mike comes running in the back door, and he's screaming, "Hey, Mom, he's getting out. What are we going to do?" You know? well, when you got them caged and they're loose, it's bad. I look back on these things, though, and I think of the things that I alone created. They say, look what that drunk does to his family. I took another look at my family. I know who did what to my kids. You see, they knew something was wrong with him. And they didn't know what to expect or what to think with me. They told me in Al-Anon to tell the children that their daddy was ill. You know, it confused the little things when I'd knock the hell out of their poor sick daddy. That's one of the hardest things, one of the hardest things I had to deal with was my role with the kids. Thank God you gave me away. We had met a couple in the program that were dear to me. They'd come by a lot. And you know, it was okay when they came by. And they'd try to talk to me. The Al-Anons were not particularly tough with me. They let me come back week after week with my stories. I think it kind of got to be like a soap opera. And by this time, Cleve had been in jail. And then I can remember the many, many things that I tried to tell him, share with him, shame him, threaten him with. One thing in particular, one night I heard a tape that I thought, oh, if I can only get my hands on that tape, it'd save his soul. The tape was by Chuck Chamberlain. Many of you will remember him. And in this particular talk, he talks about the prodigal son and compares that with the alcoholic and recovery in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it was perhaps one of the most beautiful things I ever heard. And I got my hands on that tape. And I took it home. And I offered Cleve the opportunity of listening to it. He very graciously, the first time, turned it down. So I didn't give up day after day. I offered him the opportunity of listening to that tape. And day after day, he refused me. And so I finally went to God with this. And I said, God, you know that Cleve has got to hear this tape. Now you've just got to show me the way. Well, I was in the beauty shop that afternoon and looking through a magazine, and I saw an article and it said, learn a foreign language in your sleep. I said, thank you, God. And I went home, and this was an old reel-to-reel tape player. And I managed to get that thing on there some way, got it in under the bed. Then comes the sacrifice. I had to let him back in the bedroom, you know. So, as soon as I thought he was asleep, I reach down, flick on the tape. On comes Chuck C., prodigal son, and the whole bit. Oh, man, I couldn't wait for daylight, you know. I thought I was going to see a transformation. Well, I did from, say, 6 o'clock to 10:30. He was drunk then, but didn't work. Had to do it again. This went on for about three or four nights, maybe a week, I don't know. But it wasn't long before he had developed a very deep resentment for Chuck C., the prodigal son, and me, you know. It just wasn't working. Nothing was working. One afternoon, I was in my rocker. Now, a rocker, I think you can really be pitiful in a rocker, you know. I rocked a lot. And I rocked Rebecca until her feet drug the floor. And holding a child is good too, you know. And if kind of position that rocker so that when someone walked upon the front porch, they could see us. And they come in, and as I say, you learn to let that one little tear roll down, and you know what they're going to say? What's wrong? There's your opening right there, and you can tell them. Well, this particular afternoon, Cleve was in jail. I was in my rocker, and Ruby Dee and Corny came by. And they said, what's wrong? Now, they'd been around long enough to know better than that. But I proceeded to tell them. Carney stopped me, and he said, Nell, there isn't anything that you can tell me about Cleve that I don't already know. You see, Cleve's an alcoholic, and so am I. Honey, what's your problem? And I thank God for that man, and I thank God for the words that he put in his mouth that day. And I thank God that I had had ears to hear what he said. Because for the very first time, I knew that Cleve was not my problem. I was my problem. And in spite of me, my 3 years with you had not been in vain. Things started flooding my head. You see, you had given me something in spite of me. This thing I talked about earlier. You had given me a vision. A vision beyond my circumstances. And I stayed because you had given me hope when I didn't even know what hope was. And that afternoon in May of 1965... I think I truly became an Al-Anon. Because I looked up. Now, as a last act, I got even with God that day. Because I said, God, I've tried to help you and you didn't listen. So I'm going to give Cleve to you. Oh, God, help me. Oh my, he has. You know, we talk about what happened. That's what happened. That's how things were with me. And when we talk about this thing of something happening with us, each one here who has had it knows what I'm talking about. It's that change. It's that vision. It's that desire, whatever. But you see, I knew where my answers were. I knew where my help was. And I couldn't wait to get back to my meetings. I've been in this program 28 years. I still cannot wait to get back to my meetings. Because it's ever new. Ever new. Whatever problem I have in life today, my answers are with people like you, and I know that. I think old Cleve felt that release and that relief just as surely as I did. Because about 2 weeks after I had taken my first step, he had his last drink. You know, if you're living with a practicing alcoholic, I don't want you to think this is what is necessarily going to happen in your case. But I will tell you this. I found out in that 2 week period that whether he sobered up or not, I could have a life. I just had a double joy. And we have gone together for the past 25 years. And you know, the strange thing about sobriety was it revealed my problems. all the things that we think it's going to solve, it revealed to me. And I can remember the things that I was faced with, and thank God that these things were revealed to me in a way that I could handle them, and I wasn't inundated with all of my defects of character. About the hardest thing I had in the beginning was forgiveness. And I hear a lot of young Al-Anon members talk about this, so I always try to mention this. And I was working my steps, and I was working on my fourth step, and I talked to my sponsor, and I told her, I said, oh, I want so to forgive. She said, you get on with the business at hand. Don't you know God does for you what you can't do for yourself? You ask His help each day in whatever you're doing in your program, in your life, and be patient. When you're ready, it will come. Much better than anything I had ever planned or ever dreamed. And I have to watch my expectations. And as I said, I still need to stay very close to you because I want more freedom. It's at the top of the stairs. And I know that I'll always have choices on this journey and that my choices aren't going to be destinations. I can always turn around and go back when I've made the wrong one. I want to tell you a little bit about the kids because this is family recovery. Our kids have lived far longer in recovery than they did in the illness. They didn't have an opportunity to go to Alateen. Mike was 13 when his dad had his last drink. But they developed a marvelous relationship. And I was able to make amends to these children. And they told me the best way to make amends was simply not to be that way anymore. And I've tried very hard not to ever be that way anymore. Mike went into the Navy after he graduated from high school, married his high school sweetheart. They had three children, and they're divorced now. She says he has a drinking problem. Thank God he's in Florida, and I'm in Oklahoma. Becky, my daughter-in-law, remarried. And Mike remarried last fall. About 2 weeks after, he told me he wasn't even dating anyone, so can't wait to meet her. I did not promise you perfection. I just came out that way, didn't mean it. Just can't wait to meet her. Oh. They may need me. But I do want to tell you this about Mike. He is a fine young man. He was off the coast of Lebanon a few years ago. You remember when the kamikaze trucks drove in and killed all the Marines. They were threatening to fly into his ship at that time. And you know, this is the marvelous thing about this program. You're there to remind me of the things that I need to be reminded of, and you told me that God loved him more than I did. And I can remember hearing that when I first came in, but I need to use it time and time again. And I had to very lovingly place him in God's hands. Mike evidently did a lot of thinking during that tour of duty, and we had a letter from him before he came home. And he said, Mom, I think it's time that I go to see my natural father. God works in mysterious ways. Shortly after we came into this program, I made a talk someplace, and a lady came up to me afterwards, and she said, you don't have to tell me, but I would like to know Mike's last name before you took him. And I told her, and she said, I'm his great aunt. I knew who to call to get this man's address. Isn't it something when we can look back and see God at work so many times when we don't even know he is? And I had the address and the phone number when he did come home. And I watched him pace many evenings before he made the call, and finally he did. And it was good. And this is when Becky and Mike were still together, and they gathered up three children and they went to see him. And he had a good visit and was able to fill in some gaps in his life that needed to be taken care of. And what was so wonderful about this was that Cleve and I knew that we had nothing to lose, because you've taught us how to love. You've taught us to love with an open hand. Mike was home again the next summer, and also you can't deny these kiddos any source of love either. Not if you really love them. When he came home the next summer, he said, "Mom, I'd like to make another trip out to Amarillo, but I think I'll go this week because next week is my birthday, and I'd like to be here at home for my birthday." We lost nothing. And as a result of this, I sat down one day and I thought about it many, many times, and I wrote to this man and I thanked him for the years that we had with Mike. Rebecca's an entirely different story. It's hard to release a kid sometime that moves in and out a lot, and she did. She spent a year at college, made A+ in telephone. Long distance collect. And wanted to get a job, and you know, we let her do this. And she got a job with Merrill Lynch, and she still has that job today, has done quite well, in spite of what I thought about it. It was hard for me with Rebecca, because, you know, I wanted to tell her how to dress, and I wanted to tell her the young men I thought she could go with. And she's a pretty strong-willed kiddo. So we clashed frequently. And I knew I had to release her, and I knew I had to let her be and do the child of God that she's meant to be. And I wanted to give her an ODAT. And I prayed a lot about this, and I talked to my sponsor about this. And one evening, when she was out on a date, I placed an ODAT on her pillow. Didn't mark a page. I wrote her a little letter, and I told her that I finally could love her enough to let her go. And I think she felt the release. Because as a result of that, our relationship changed. And this is one of my favorite stories about Rebecca. She started sending me flowers. And, you know, for no occasion, I'd get this lovely, lovely bouquet of flowers. And it wasn't long before I had the nicest little collection of florist cards. And her father had the nicest little stack of florist bills. And she's no dummy. But you see, she manipulates that man just exactly like I did my father. Just exactly. And when she married, she didn't have the kind of wedding I had planned or dreamed. But it was beautiful. Her father was a state trial judge, and he performed the ceremony. He walked her down the aisle. I did all work. You know how it is. But it was beautiful. Really prettier than anything that I had planned or dreamed for her. Then she had a little boy, and we're just 35 miles from this grandchild, so I have to be very careful. His name is Stephen. He was 4 the other day. I'm probably the only grandmother you ever heard of that's been called Commissioner Jordan Gordon. If you watch Batman, you'll know what I'm talking about. And that's okay. Rebecca had ear surgery Monday. She's deaf in her left ear, has been since birth. And this was microscopic surgery of some kind in Dallas. They go in and patch the middle ear. I went home with them and stayed with her until I had to get ready and packed to come here. And right before I came tonight, I called and they'd rushed her back to Dallas. I don't know what for. But I want to tell you something right now. This program works. Before I left, I very lovingly placed her in God's hands. And I got a hug from Blanche, and that helped. And you know, I'm where I'm supposed to be because I can't do anything for her. But I feel like everything's going to be as it should be. Hey, remember that baby I prayed for? About 4 years into the program, I quit smoking. Felt weird, went to the doctor, was pregnant. Came home, I said, hey, Clee, we're living proof. You don't have to smoke or drink to have a good time. Well, you can just imagine how delighted we were. The kids were delighted. Mike was 16. Rebecca was almost 8. I'm not going to tell you how old I was. But anyway, I thought, okay, God, if you want a Medicare mother, that's okay with me. And it was wonderful. Gosh, Cleve and I'd lay awake at night and we'd talk about, we knew it was going to be a boy. And we would talk about all the things that he would do. And December the 7th of 1968, I gave birth to Christopher. And when I held him in my arms, I knew that our dreams would never come true because my baby had Down syndrome. And we stood by his bed and we cried. And we prayed. And we prayed for God to change this. We loved him so much and accepted him. But we just didn't want anything to be wrong with him. You know, God looked on his heart. He didn't see anything wrong with that kid. He saw absolute love and performed the greatest miracle of all. He changed us and truly granted us the serenity to accept this that we could not change. And you know, as a result of this, because of you, I have so many gifts. The gifts of Christopher, a little boy they call retarded. We say we just don't think his mind is filled with all the crap that ours is. But I want to tell you something. We learned the difference in acceptance and resignation. We learned the difference in expectations and hope. In hope, there's trust. There's trust in this loving God that you've shared with me, that I have come to know. And then Christopher gave me a gift. His very first gift, as I held him one day, he was about 9 months old, and I thanked this loving God for the fact that that little boy sat up that day and was rejoicing in his progress. And as I looked at him and I looked at each so-called physical defect, and thought about how much I loved each one. It dawned on me, now this is how God loves you, just the way you are. With all of your defects of character, God loves you now. And he rejoices, even though your progress is slow. What greater gift could a child give his mother? But I could stand here the rest of the night and share many, many more with you. He was 21 in December. He's still quite childlike, but quite grown up in many ways, like he told us in June. Dad, I'm a man like you, and I'd like to have a Father's Day present. But for his 21st birthday, he wanted a reception. And he wanted to rent a tux. Tails. We thought, why not? So we decided to have it at the church, and we just put a little notice in the church bulletin that Christopher was going to celebrate his birthday, and anyone who would like to come and have cake and punch with us, that we would love to have them there. And so we put the time and so forth, and 100 people showed up that afternoon. There was a table of gifts, and there was a little boy in a light gray tux with a hot pink cummerbund and a bow tie. And he looked wonderful. And you know, he's whatever he has on. He was pure sophistication that afternoon. Naturally, it's all on tape. I didn't bring it. And he made a speech. And he stood up in front of all the people. And he said, you are my family. You are my friends. And then he introduced his family that was there, my mother, and all who were related to us. And he told each one how much he loved them. And there wasn't a dry eye in the house when he got through. And I thought, a friend of mine and I sat there and watched him, and she says, you know, I watch him when he performs. He's quite a little dancer. He loves to pretend that he's a country western singer. Occasionally, he's a member of AA and an alcoholic. And she said, I love watching Chris because he's simply whatever he wants to be. He does this without a mind-altering or mood-changing chemical. He's pure joy. When he was 12, he had to go away from home to a school because we lost our class in our public school. And would have gained nothing for him had we sued. It was a hard decision, but he was excited because he thought he was going to college. You see, Christopher simply reaches out and embraces each experience in reality. He's not afraid. I'm so glad because of you I can recognize these things. My heart was so heavy then I couldn't see it. And I attended the last assembly program at public school, and I watched them give out the certificates. It was an awards assembly. And finally, they gave a little certificate to the kiddos who had read 25 books or more. And you can imagine my surprise when Christopher's teacher went to the podium and she said, I too have a certificate to give this year. Christopher Largent has read one book. My heart stood still. because we can love him and rejoice in whatever he does, because he's the best he can be. Why didn't I see that in my kids? I do now, because of a little boy they call retarded. The time came, we packed his clothes and we took him to school. He couldn't wait for us to leave. Ready to get on with this new experience. We cried all the way home. He didn't. But you see, we learned something that day. Christopher's happiness does not depend on us. And isn't that wonderful? Thank God I can see that. I can recognize that. Oh, he lives in his own world, and I can allow him his perception of reality. He still believes in Santa. We stand in line and have our picture made with him every year. And you know, I watch people as we go to this line, and they give us weird looks, you can imagine. This little old lady and a kid that shaves. And that's okay. But you know, before long, Christopher knows everyone up and down the line, and he sings Christmas carols, and when they're up there, he tells the little ones not to be afraid, that Santa's their friend. And these are symbols. I realize that he loves Christmas, and these symbols of Christmas are so meaningful to him. He loves the nativity scene. And he'll put up a Christmas tree in July in his room and play Christmas carols. And I think that's wonderful. Christmas is a state of mind. And it can be in July as far as Chris is concerned. I tell you these things simply because had it not been for you, I would have known none of them. I think about his first trip to camp and how excited he was, and all the things that we did to get ready. And when we got there, he bailed out of the car and he ran up to the first person he saw and he said, "Hi, Hemp." He couldn't say camp. He couldn't say courthouse either. He called it the whorehouse. You know what I did, don't you? Tell him where Daddy works, honey. But he ran up to this person and he said, "Hi, Hemp." And she said, "Well, hi there, my name is Barbara." And he said, "Oh." And so he ran up to another adult, "Hi, Hemp." And they in turn told him their name. And then he went on into registration and He went up to each person at the desk and would get right down in their face and say, "Hi, Hemp." And you can imagine, he was getting this look on his face. Well, where is it? We took him down to his cabin, and a fine-looking young man came out of the cabin, and I assumed that that was to be his counselor for the week, so I ran ahead to fix it. And I told Rick the problem that Chris was having. And when Chris got to Rick, he said, "Hi, Hemp." But Rick stuck out his hand and he said, "Hi, Christopher, I'm Camp." And you should have seen the look on his face. And you know, I knew how he felt. Because when I came to you, I didn't know who you were. I didn't know what you were. But you held out your arms to me. You said, "Hi, Nell, I'm Al-Anon." Thank God I stayed. Thank God I kept coming back, just like Chris couldn't wait to go back to camp the next summer. You've been all to me that you told me you would be. You've done this simply by sharing your experience, your strength, and your hope with me. You continue to give me the vision beyond my circumstances that I need so often. You give me new freedoms. You give me love. because of that, I can be here tonight and share a bit with you. For that, I'm grateful. And I'd like to leave you with a little blessing. This place is so beautiful. May the silence of the hills, the joy of the winds, the peace of the fields, the music of the birds, the fire of the sun, the strength of the trees, and the faith of a wee child, and all of which is God, be in your heart. Thank you.